Welcome to Gulf Coast Life. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. Today, we're going to talk about kids and neurodiversity. It may show itself as a challenge for a student in school, or it may be a challenge for a student socially. A student may have trouble staying focused, engaged in learning. They may have trouble communicating, some struggle with anxiety. It's a very wide-ranging issue. Also here on the show, we have Dr. Michael Rizzo, who's a psychologist with offices in Naples and Fort Myers, as well as in the Miami area. He works with children to understand root causes if they're having less than desirable outcomes in school or at home. He joins us by teleconference, and we're joined in the studio by Lily Abunader, age 15, a sophomore from Bonita Springs, and also her mother is here, Mrs. Abunader. Hello. Welcome to everyone. By the way, Lily has struggled with dyslexia and ADHD in the past, but she's now thriving. So thank you all for coming and being here. Dr. Rizzo, let's start with you. In case people aren't familiar, what is neurodiversity?
I think the phenomena of giving kids labels is, we're moving beyond that.
Okay.
Because in a general population of students with average or better intelligence, there's always going to be a number of those kids that have variations in the architecture of their brain that make certain tasks much more difficult for them than for other kids with average or better intelligence. So there's specific constellations of weaknesses in neural networks that create a very difficult time learning to read, regardless of the quality of your instruction, regardless of the sophistication of the school you're in. Now, when you think about the numbers for dyslexia, some recent research indicates that 17 to 27% of kids have dyslexia, which means it's not a disability. It's a variation in traits, in cognitive traits that make it difficult to acquire reading. But if you're a kid that has difficulty acquiring reading skills and you have average or better intelligence, the years from kindergarten to fifth grade are traumatic. You're going to school every day and all you want to do is earn status in your classroom community. You're just as smart as the other kids, but no matter how hard you try, you can't keep up. So we have this fallout of a lot of anxiety and a lot of attention problems with kids with dyslexia simply because it's so much harder to carry the load. And they get fatigued much more easily, and they recognize they're not keeping up with their peers, and it sets off the fear center or the threat center in the lower levels of the brain that evolved in evolution to keep you safe, and then it just becomes a cycle of getting worse and worse unless you have the right teachers, the right environment, and the right remediation to become competitive in that classroom environment. That was a lot of words. Did that make sense?
No, that was a very helpful description. So, Lily, maybe you can, I know you and your mom were both nodding along with Dr. Rizzo. Can you tell us a bit of your story? Was it in those years, kindergarten through fifth, when you started to struggle? Can you kind of tell us, when did you first notice that you were having problems? Or I don't even know what to call it. Just, tell us how it went for you.
Yeah, so definitely, I mean, as early as I can remember, like kindergarten, just those foundational reading skills that you should have developed by the time you come out of kindergarten, I feel like I did not have. That's was one of my main issues. And then it does cause anxiety because you want to be competitive in your classroom, like Dr. Rizzo said, but that's very difficult when you don't have foundational reading skills.
And then it must just get worse. I mean, if you don't have the foundation, then did it kind of get worse each year or how did it go?
Yeah, I mean, you do definitely start to learn how to read and it gets a little better as you get older just from prior knowledge, repetition. But yeah, it does get worse in terms of what level you're on compared to your grade level.
Mm. And Mom, do you mind chiming in? Like, what were you noticing? That's quite young, kindergarten. What were you noticing?
Absolutely. I think what Dr. Rizzo was pointing out, too, is that they develop a lot of compensatory skills. These are not kids with below average intelligence. These are really smart kids who figure out how to get around these things day in and day out. And that's exhausting. So she did have a level of fatigue that was beyond her years, you know, and her general activity of what she was doing. But we didn't necessarily put the pieces together at that point because she was still keeping grade level. No one at the school was calling me and saying, she's really falling behind or she's disruptive in the classroom. It was the opposite. You know, she's a joy. She's a pleasure to have around. You know, she's really just a great kid. And so she just was wearing herself out trying to keep up, but still managing to do it, which really, I think, delayed our identification of some of the issues.
And once you were able to identify them, were you able to get help at school or how did the help start for you?
Yeah, so I was able to get help at school. I have what's a 504 plan. So you get some certain accommodations. You know, I got extra time on testing and small group to take some of that anxiety off. But I think more towards the end of middle school and then now into high school is where I'm able to get the most amount of help.
What kinds of help are you getting now?
I think it's the same services, but
yeah.
She has learned really how to advocate for herself to maximize those
and
services.
And how to really use those services really well, you know. Small group is great, but if you don't know how to use that to your advantage, then it's just, it doesn't.
It's not that helpful.
It's not that helpful.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I want to ask you later about kind of some specific strategies that you use too. But Dr. Rizzo, in your experience, are schools generally helpful? Are they able to address kids' challenges or are they not successful? Or can you just speak to that a little bit? I don't even know if you can generalize, but.
Well, I've been doing this a long time, and schools have moved in the right direction, but they fall far short of creating an environment that fosters success for kids that are innately not good readers. If you think in the evolution of education, schools were designed in the early 1900s for only kids that were great at reading, could sit still and focus for a long time, and had a lot of support at home. Now, there's a lot of kids that do not enjoy reading and do not have a brain style that lends itself to being still. And they don't have a lot of support at home. Now, it sounds like in our situation we're talking about here, there was an incredible amount of support from home and a student with an incredible work ethic. But as she said, she had to work so much harder than her peers to get to the same place. So in this day and age, if we identify learning challenges very early, K to two, there's a good chance to remediate and make that person at least an average reader. But there's also about half of those kids that don't respond even to the best interventionists that are out there. And intervention is very costly and very time consuming. So it precludes a lot of families from being even able to understand or access that early intervention. In this day and age as well, if you have a really clear picture of what the student's needs are, using voice to text and using audio books and having notes provided and having extended time and having use of a calculator, not to make it easier, but to take the fatigue away so you can stay competitive, is where everything is moving. So if you learn by listening or you learn by reading, neither is an indication of your intelligence, your ability to read or your ability to listen. Those are only mechanisms to get knowledge into your brain. So if kids are not good readers, now, even if you appear to overcome your dyslexia by fifth grade, typically what's remnants of that when you're in high school is fluency. You're still slow at reading, which still puts you at a disadvantage. Even though your word recognition and your comprehension are okay, you just take so much longer than the other kids. So there's a long way to go, and probably many public schools and many private schools have taken giant steps in the last 10 years to recognize dyslexia. But they're still far, far short of creating the environment where those kids can foster and be all they can be.
And Lily, do you notice, like, do you have friends and classmates with similar problems? Or I'm sorry to call it a problem. Not sure what to call it, a challenge.
I think you should call it a learning style difference that doesn't match the way the teacher teaches. It's a teaching disability, not a learning disability.
I love that.
The teachers aren't equipped to understand how those kids learn.
Right.
Yes, I see that.
And
often.
Do you all like help each other or how do you work with that?
I mean, we try to help each other. Yeah, so but also we try to help whoever needs it.
Yes. Are you using, I thought that was interesting what Dr. Rizzo said about voice to text and audiobooks and that kind of thing. Are you using those sort of technological advances to help you?
Yes, I love audiobooks. Most of the reading that I do is audiobooks with the text. But as for talk-to-text, I don't use it as much at school, but definitely in my personal life, I do.
Is there any, I mean, I know that when people say, just in the reading world, oh, I listen to that audiobook, they think it's like cheating or like there's a stigma, like it's not really reading or something. Do you feel any kind of stigma about that? Or
personally, no. I think that these accommodations are to put me on level with my peers. They are not to give me an advantage. They're also not any kind of cheat or shortcut.
And Dr. Rizzo, do you find that any teachers or anyone you work with or parents even are don't want to use those technological advances, or they feel like it's not, they're not, quote, really reading? Or is there any kind of stigma that you see around that?
Well, the only stigma is that if you're in a culture, an environment where it's accepted as there's diverse ways to learn, mm-hmm. then using all these tools is just part of the culture of that environment. So some private schools that have started in the lower grades to allow these things, by the time the kids are middle school or high school, you know, it's common. It's just like the way some of the kids do it, and it's not seen as you're different or you have a disability. But if the culture of the school is that if you have a reading problem, you know, you have a label and you're disabled, then no kid wants to let the world know they're disabled. So they try to hide it. They try to like protect their sense of self-esteem by trying to push through the work without using the accommodation. So it has to do with the culture that the school creates around diversity, around learning diversity. Because if you have a place, you know, I have private schools that kids are allowed to use. There's something called CPEN readers where you can scan it like with a magic marker and it reads the page to you. They have Speechify, which reads the page to you. They have all the computers now will read the screen to you. Now, we also, when we test kids, we compare listening comprehension to reading comprehension. You can have a fifth grader with listening comprehension at a ninth grade level and reading comprehension at a second grade level. Mm-hmm. So why would we torture that kid by making him read or her read with their eyes when they can read seven grade levels higher with their ears? Mm-hmm. You have to think about reading with your ears or reading with your eyes. It's only the sensory system that gets the knowledge to your brain. So what's the difference if it came through your eyes or your ears? Mm-hmm. As things evolve, there's more and more understanding that being dyslexic is not a disability. It's a learning style that doesn't match the way teachers were trained to teach.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking with psychologist Dr. Michael Rizzo and Bonita Springs sophomore Lily Abunader about managing neurodiversity and different learning styles. Dr. Rizzo, what do you wish all teachers knew about different learning styles or parents and teachers?
To be honest, I'm getting older, but I hope I still have some more steam left in the engine to keep going, because I do a lot of teacher trainings. I go to schools all over the state. Maybe 20, 25 times a year, I do presentations to faculties. And when I leave, they say, why didn't anyone ever teach me this before? I think we have a gap in education that we're still training teachers that the only way to learn is falling into traditional paradigms of being a good reader. We have project-based learning. We have group activities. We have audio books. There's so many ways to learn and every brain is different and responds better to one type of a classroom environment than others. So the ball is moved. You know, we've moved it a little bit, but there's still so far to go, and there's still more traditional environments where everyone insists you sit up straight and you sit in straight rows and you read, and they just, you know, read. You have to read. No matter how hard it is, you have to read. And those kids are, you know, a second grader that doesn't read well, and they go home and they complain to their mom. The mom typically, historically, would say, don't worry, you only have 10 years to go. Keep trying hard. Now that's absurd. We have to help the second grader that can't read to change the way the environment is groomed to teach them so it matches their brain. And we're getting there, but it's so slow.
And also, I mean, you don't stop having the need to read when you graduate from high school. You know, everybody needs to be able to read, especially now with we're all on our phones and on the internet and so forth, and we're just reading a lot. Not to mention that kid is probably so frustrated and angry by the time they're in 12th grade. It's very interesting. Well, Lily, okay. I wanted to ask you, do you have any specific tools that you use that you know I need to do such and such when I take a test, or I know this will help me with my dyslexia, or I know that this doesn't really help me?
The main tool I use now is small group testing, which I have for any test I take. If I want to use it, I can. And it takes a lot of that general classroom, that external pressure off, so I can just focus on what I need to do. And it's kind of like a nice breath of fresh air when I'm trying to take an assessment. You get pulled out, which some people really don't like, but I don't mind it. And they take you to a different environment, a different classroom with less people in it.
What Lily's pointing out is when you are in an environment where you look around and you clearly see that you're not keeping up with the other kids, it sets off a threat response. And the threat response sets off the limbic system, which is deep down in your brain. And then that changes the constellation of chemicals going to the frontal cortex, which accompanies anxiety. And when you have cortisol and noradrenaline in the frontal cortex as a consequence of feeling threat in a large group setting where you can't keep up, it fogs your ability to think clearly. You can't learn in an anxious, agitated, emotionally dysregulated state because you're feeling fear because you can't keep up with the other kids. So when you're in a small group working at your own pace, it's much less threat. So when there's much less threat, you're actually, if I get really technical here, your parasympathetic nervous system starts to step in and the sympathetic nervous system calms down and you can go into flow state. So you can really get into the story and get into what you're doing without feeling anxiety. And then you actually get your best performance. So there's a lot of reasons extra time or small groups are important that go beyond the obvious.
Huh.
And it's about the chemistry of your cortex, your frontal cortex, and the fear response and the threat response and feeling inadequate. If you're in a safe place, you learn better than when you're in a threatening place. And a small environment is a safe place.
That is fascinating. So if you see, like, let's say the kid in front of you is, you can see he's 5 pages ahead of you, you're just going to kind of like shut down.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Wow. Lily, what would you tell a student if you were a big sister to a student in second grade or something coming up with different learning styles? Is there anything, like, what have you learned on your journey that you would like to pass on to younger kids?
I would tell them that being able to advocate for yourself is very important because other people can tell your story for you. They can try, your parents can email and do whatever, but ultimately, you know yourself and your struggles best. So you have to be able to verbalize that to other people. And then also, you're not any less than anyone else. Just because you've struggled with these things, that does not change how smart you are or how much potential you have.
That's great. Do you have any comment on that, Dr. Rizzo?
I have a comment. You know that MIT has the largest number of dyslexics of any university in the world.
Oh, how fascinating.
Because there's a gift that comes with dyslexia, too. It's not only a curse. Most entrepreneurs, people that think outside of the box, they have a profile. Einstein was said to be the dumbest lad in the class. Da Vinci they can't read his notes to this day that he tried to take when he was inventing things. It just goes on and on that it is not a disease or a disability. It's a trait style that gives you strengths in areas that don't always reflect as those skills you need to be good at school. But entrepreneurship and creativity and innovation and imagination are more present in dyslexic kids than in good readers.
Oh, that's so interesting. Lily, do you like reading now? How do you feel about reading, I should say?
Funny enough, yeah, actually, I do like reading now.
Do you mostly, if you're just reading something for fun, do you usually listen to an audiobook?
Yeah, but reading, you know, for school and stuff like that has definitely gotten much easier.
Yeah. Do you find that there are more and more books that are available in that format, or?
Yeah, there's plenty of places that you can find basically any audiobook you want. Kindle, Learning Ally is a really good one for students. So, Libby.
Wow. Yes.
Lily's enlightened, but not every kid has the opportunity to reach the point of awareness that Lily has. Yes. And those are the struggling kids, and there's scores and scores of those struggling kids that no one's identified as dyslexic, but that are really smart kids. So I'm so happy to hear Lily sounds like she should be the poster child for the kid who's managing their dyslexia to the best, to the max. And they don't understand. They see they're not broken. They just learn differently. But we have so many kids that don't have the option to even be captured, to be identified, that are just struggling. And then the anxiety and the mood dysregulation and the oppositional defiance that sometimes occurs, or the apathy that sometimes occurs, those are all symptoms, not problems, of the chronic micro traumas those kids experience each day trying to manage school.
And Dr. Rizzo, is there anything to be done? What would you like, ideally, what would you like to see helping for those kids? And is it a matter of training the teachers and getting different ways of thinking in the classroom? Or what are your thoughts on that?
You're asking. I'm like the radical want to make change person, but I think identifying kids K to two and providing intensive remedial support early, and for those kids that don't respond well by fourth grade, having a pathway toward learning to use all the tools to be a successful student like Lily has is where we need to focus all of our attention, because not everyone that gets early intervention will become a good reader. Some will not, even no matter how many tutors or how many hours they spend with reading. But you have to continue to try to slowly improve the reading even through adulthood. You just don't bail out on traditional reading, but you have to find another way to access knowledge without using traditional reading methods, which is listening. And, SAT, ACT, AP exams, you can have all those exams in audio form now. If you have a documented history of learning disabilities, they'll give you little audio files to listen instead of read. You can go through med school without reading or writing one word, but you have to know what you're doing to advocate for yourself and access to support you need, which most people don't know how to do it.
And mom, do you have any advice or anything to add about, it seems like you've taught Lily quite well to advocate for herself, but is there anything any advice you would give to other, or maybe you do give to other families who are struggling with this?
I do. Yes, I give a lot of maybe unsolicited feedback. Because I sometimes see it more clearly because I have lived it. But I think before anybody in our circle knew the word neurodivergent, we understood the word individual. And so having a child, especially my first child, I just treated her as an individual. And all of those things I just thought were particular to her. I did not have, even as a medical professional, the training, and as part of my education that said, these are things you should be looking for so that you can identify this earlier. And I think it's a lot to put it on just the teachers in the school system when they get there. So I think we need more education really on the front end, on the pediatrician side, on the parenting things that are out there where people are going to get information about just raising young children, because we could be doing a lot to help them before they even get to school. So I think knowing your kid, understanding like, hey, these things are kind of particular to my child, but also they may be indicative of a larger difference in learning. And I agree completely with Dr. Rizzo. This is a superpower. This is not a disability. There are things that I see Lily capable of that I'm like, okay, I don't even know how you are harnessing this mental capacity to be this amazing. Like, it's just that much of an ability. So reducing the stigma, removing the stigma is really our first line of defense.
That's great. I'm afraid we're running out of time. Is there anything that anybody would like to add? Just a quick last thought, Dr. Rizzo?
I just think we must never leap to ADHD or anxiety as being the problem without assessing what's underneath the hood. Because anxiety and ADHD are the symptoms of a kid that has to work so much harder than the other kids to get to the same place that has average or better intelligence. So I just wouldn't want parents, when their kids are anxious, they don't need SSRIs or psychotherapy initially. Maybe some do. I mean, but in many cases, it's secondary to the poor fit between the demands the classroom is putting on them and their inability to manage those demands. Like someone that goes to work every day and can't do what their boss wants, and comes home anxious or depressed or angry. We do this to kids every day when we put them in a setting where their skill sets don't match what's required for success in that learning environment. In a nutshell, where we need to focus on making the match better between how each kid's brain is designed and how the teachers are trying to teach them.
Yes, thank you, Lily. Any last thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with Dr. Rizzo. I think that dyslexia does not have to be a disability. You should use it to your advantage. We're typically very outside-of-the-box thinkers, good at art, music. You know, you should really hone those powers because they're very special.
Thank you all so much. We have been talking with psychologist Dr. Michael Rizzo and Bonita Springs sophomore Lily Abunadar about managing neurodiversity and various learning strategies, as well as her mother. Thank you all so much for being on the show today. It's been a really, really interesting conversation. Thank you for listening to Gulf Coast Life. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. We had production help today from Mike Canary and Emma Rodriguez. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.